So we will be, I'll introduce what we'll be doing for the main lesson tonight here in a minute. But before we dig into the book of Genesis, how many of you have been reading the book of the month? Let's see. It's quite a few of you. How many of you have enjoyed it? So one of the things we're going to do with the books of the month, we may not do this every week, but as we have occasion, there's a reading schedule in the bulletin. And so we have, you know, basically a chapter or so that we'll be reading each week. And so what I'm hoping to do is just take a couple minutes on Sunday nights and talk about the chapters that we've, or have opportunity for questions about the chapters that we read, the chapter that we read that week, or if it's been a couple of weeks over the past couple of weeks. And so we've had 2 weeks of the reading schedule so far. So we've read from pages 1 through 46, and that covers the introduction and the introductory material and the first daily habit. And there's one a quote from that that I wanted to read to you that really captures the heart of the book. And so perhaps some of you who have not started to read it yet will be inspired by this to pick it up and get started. The point is, as he put it, quoting another writer, "The most obvious important realities are often the ones that are hardest to see and talk about. As far as our habits go, the invisible reality is this: we are all living according to a specific regimen of habits, and those habits shape most of our life. A habit is a behavior that occurs automatically over and over, and often unconsciously. A study from Duke University suggested that as much as 40% of the actions we take every day are not the products of choices, but of habits. As William James put it, all our life, so far as it has definite forms, is but a mass of habits. The problem is, as Wallace suggested," that's one of the writers he quoted earlier, "that much of what is fundamentally shaping our existence is happening unconsciously. But just because we don't choose our habits doesn't mean we don't have them. On the contrary, it usually means someone else chose them for us, and usually that someone doesn't have our best interest in mind. Take your work schedule or your social media scrolling, for example. Think about your internet history or how you spent your mornings last week. Think about what you usually eat for lunch or the time you spend with family versus the time you spend looking at a screen during a normal day. These things define vast portions of our lives, and while we would like to think we've carefully chosen them, most often we haven't even given them a second thought. Most often we just swim along with what those around us are doing, and much more often than we would like to admit or even understand, we are nudged into those choices by those who want to make money off the patterns of our daily life. Social media doesn't just happen, and not just social media, but television and really every form of media is designed to nudge you into certain habits that make money for those doing the nudging, and to do so in such a way that you are completely unaware that you are being nudged and you think it's a result of your own conscious choice. That's why Google is worth $1 trillion, because they're really good at nudging people and other companies as well. This wouldn't be so bad if it weren't for the fact that habits form much more than our schedules. They form our hearts. And that really is the heart of the book, is that our habits don't only shape our schedules. They form our hearts, and therefore we cannot afford to be unintentional about the habits that structure our days. Does anyone have any questions or comments? We won't take a long time for this, about either the introductory section or the first habit. The first habit is kneeling prayer 3 times a day, at morning, noon, and night. And all of these habits are not so much a prescriptive rule. I was talking to Pastor Dave about this earlier, that everyone has to do all of these habits exactly as the author suggested. But really, it's designed to get you to think about how intentional the habits that you do have in place really are and the effect that those habits are having in your life. So does anyone have anything they want to throw out there about the reading of the past couple weeks before we start digging into Genesis? Over here? Over here? Well, I guess not. We'll move on. Pastor Dave.
It wasn't so much a question, perhaps a comment, is that I realize and I recognize about reading the book that you're talking about external stimuli being what can drive us to do things. Mm-hmm.
Yep.
Why am I doing this?
Mm-hmm.
Rather than, like, you know, the eight-step method for making this happen. Well, okay, now I have this prescriptive method for making it happen, but oftentimes I don't always go back and ask, well, why do I really need to do this in the first place?
Mm-hmm.
And you just go down the path. And you feel like you've accomplished something when you get through that eight steps of whatever it is. But at the same time, feel accomplished, and so it becomes to you or to me or to anybody a feeling of accomplishment, and so you want to, whenever you want to have a feeling of accomplishment, you do those eight steps and you feel like you've done something, but really what does it matter?
And I think one of the real strengths of the book is if you think of it as here's a one-size-fit-all set of things that everyone should be doing, that really misses what's good about the book, because what's good about the book is the way that it's very thoughtful, and it helps you to think through the way that even if you don't adopt the particular habits he suggests, his point is for you to be intentional in the habits you do adopt, that you think through the way the habits that you may have picked up by osmosis from others, the liturgies, as it were, of your day are shaping your heart, and think, is that the way I want my heart to be shaped? And maybe there's some changes that I need to make. And even if you already have very good habits, there's always room for all of us to improve.
Which shepherd are you?
Yes, exactly. And that, you know, there are shepherds out there who want you to follow them, and it is social media is so dominant in our day, but it's not just social media. It's the liturgies of the day of the newspaper and the television and really whatever the medium of mass communication is, and every society has it, that's someone's trying to shape you for their profit. And God wants to shape you to be like Jesus. And so that means at some point you're going to have to resist how others are trying to shape you. So let's go before the Lord in prayer, and we'll dig into Genesis. Father, I come before you. I thank you for how good you are. I thank you for your beauty and your word. I pray, Father, Lord, you would give strength and help us to be faithful to you. In Christ's name I pray, amen. So as most of you know, at our neighborhood fellowships, we were going through the book of Genesis. And as we launched the Bible reading schedule this year, we decided it would be profitable to use the Bible reading schedule for the day as the basis for what we're doing in our neighborhood fellowships. And so we're supplying fewer notes, we're reading more chapters, and so far, at least in my group, it's gone rather well, and we have a meeting we'll have scheduled with the other leaders to see how that's been going in other groups as well. But what we'll be doing, we don't want to just drop Genesis, and so we'll be moving it to Sunday night. And one of the things that I'm thinking about doing, it depends on how this works, so I'm not making a promise that this is what I'm going to do. So if you have any helpful feedback on this point, I'd appreciate it. But I'm really thinking about making this what we do on a regular basis on Sunday night. So when we're done with Genesis, plowing right through to Exodus and basically going through a chapter or so at a time. And I'll be experimenting a little bit in the next couple weeks with the exact format, because I've been writing notes for some time for the neighborhood fellowship, but how to sort of change that up to the format we have on Sunday night. So any feedback that you all have, either in the course of discussion tonight or privately afterwards, I would appreciate it. And so where we left off in our neighborhood fellowships is in Genesis 41. And actually, the last week of notes that we had was Genesis 41a, but that was like 6 or 7 weeks ago. And so I thought, you know, sort of picking up with Genesis 41b and saying, as you remember, 6 weeks ago when half of the neighborhood fellowships didn't meet because of sickness, we did this. And I just really didn't think that would work very well. And so we'll be starting at the beginning of Genesis 41 and making it through as much of the chapter as we can, hopefully the whole thing. But before we dig into Genesis 41, we've been out of Genesis for a few weeks, so I just want to go over the big picture of the book as we have on several other occasions, and rather briefly in this context. After the creational prologue in Genesis 1:1 through 2:3, Genesis is divided into 10 toledot, or generations, headings. So you have an introduction and you have 10 sections. And those 10 sections are divided into two groups of 5 sections each. So you have the prologue, which deals with the origin of the world, and then you have the first 5 toledot, which deal with the origins of the nations. And that lasts from 2:4 to 11:26. So you have the generations of the heaven and the earth in 2:4 through 4:26, the generations of Adam, the generations of Noah, the generations of the sons of Noah, and the generations of Shem. And in the generations of Shem, you get the story, well, you get the story of the Tower of Babel, and then you get the generations of Shem, and then you have Abraham coming on the scene. And so the first half of those 5 sections deals with the origins of the nations. And it tells you how the God who created the heavens and the earth came to focus his saving work in the world on the one particular family, namely the family of Abraham. And then you have, in the next 5 sections, the origins of Israel. And so you have 5 toledot that give the origins of Israel. And in the second half of the book, there's a, and of course these halves are not equal, they're halves based on the number of sections, but you have this very small prologue, the origins of the world, and then you have a little bit longer on the origins of the nations, and then the bulk of the book is on the origins of Israel, which really makes sense given that it's introducing the Pentateuch, which tells about how Israel became a nation. You have the Exodus, and then you have a full third of the Pentateuch is the time at Mount Sinai. But in the 5 sections in the second half of the book of Genesis, you have this alteration between a long section that'll deal with the seed of promise and a short section that will deal with the past overline. So you have the first of these 5 sections is the generations of Terah, and that lasts from 11:27 through 25:11. So is that a long or a short section? Long. I'm hearing long. So this is going to be, Lord willing, a relatively interactive time. So feel free to talk. We'll have opportunity as we go through the sections to ask questions, to make comments, and we'll be discussing this together. And then the generations of Terah, who's the main character? Abraham. Abraham is the main character. And then you have the generations of Ishmael, and that goes from chapter 25, verse 12 to chapter 25, verse 18. So is that long or short? That's short. And it deals, of course, with the generations of Ishmael. And then you have the generations of Isaac from 25:19 through 35:29. Is that long or short? Long. And it, who does it focus on? The generations of Isaac. Who's the main character? Jacob. And then you have the generations of Esau, which goes from 36:1 to 37:1. So basically one chapter. That's short. And then you have the section that we're in now, and that's the generations of Jacob. And in 37:2, you have these words, "These are the generations of Jacob." And this final section of the book of Genesis focuses on the story of Joseph and Judah. It's not only the story of Joseph. Of course, Joseph gets more verses than Judah does, but they both are very significant characters in the final section of Genesis, which is no surprise as it's introducing the origin of the nation of Israel, because the dominant tribes throughout Israel's history as a nation were the tribes of Judah on the one hand and Ephraim and Manasseh, the sons of Joseph, on the other hand. And so these, even though there were 12 tribes, these become the dominant tribes. And there's no passed over line needed after the relation of the story of the 12 patriarchs, because all 12 of the patriarchs became part of the nation of Israel. So you have this process of selection that takes place where you have Abraham and not the other sons of Terah, and you have Jacob and not Esau, and you have this, so you have Isaac and not Ishmael, And then you have Jacob and not Esau. But when you get to the descendants of Jacob, all 12 of them become part of the, despite their deficiencies, become part of the promised line. And so digging in to the generations of Jacob, in chapter 37, we have Joseph being sold into slavery. And in chapter 38, we have the misadventures of Judah. And on the most likely reading, there's some dispute about the chronology, but the view that seems the most convincing to me is that the story of Judah that unfolds over the course of Genesis 38 occupies almost exactly the same amount of time as the story of Joseph that unfolds over 39 through 41. And there's a number of overlaps between the two stories. So both of them are said, and the same language is used, to go down from their family. So Judah goes down to the Canaanites, Joseph goes down to Egypt. Both of them encounter a seductive woman. Judah encounters Tamar, and Joseph encounters Potiphar's wife. Both of them, as we'll find today, father two children with a foreign woman while they're apart from their families. So there's a lot of parallels between the two accounts. And depending on how you read Joseph's character in chapter 37, so some would see him as a type of Christ from the beginning and would defend his behavior in chapter 37 as well. Others would see that Joseph's behavior in chapter 37 is rather arrogant, and he becomes humble over the course of his story. And so if you read Genesis 37 in that way, then you see there's another parallel, and that is that both of their characters are significantly transformed. So it depends on how you read. It's a little bit ambiguous, chapter 37. But in any case, there are a number of similarities between the way that the story of Judah is told and the way that the story of Joseph is told. And so as you're telling the story of the sons of Jacob, we have two sons in parallel, and we have very similar things happening to both of them. And then, so we have Judah in chapter 38. In chapter 39, we have Joseph in Potiphar's house. And in chapter 40, we have Joseph in prison. Actually, the chapter breaks are a little bit off. But we have three scenes of Joseph's time in Egypt. We have Potiphar's house, we have the prison, and we have Pharaoh's house. And the first two sections, 39:1 through 20 and 39:21 through 40 through 23, so the sections that deal with Potiphar's house and the time in the prison, they follow a very similar structural pattern. So you have an initial statement at the beginning: God is with Joseph, causing him to prosper in a new and difficult environment. And then you have a narrative section introduced in both cases by after these things. And both of these first two scenes end with Joseph's faithful service being forgotten and unrewarded. So you have a pattern that's set. God's with Joseph, Joseph prospers, and after Joseph prospers, something happens, and Joseph's faithful service gets punished instead of rewarded. So you have this pattern that's set. Happens once, happens twice, and now you have the third scene. And as chapter 41 opens, there's no initial statement about God being with Joseph. So you have a pattern set. God's with Joseph. God's with Joseph. And then you start the third chapter, you start the third section, and it doesn't say that God's with Joseph anymore. And given the way the previous two stories have turned out, it causes the reader to wonder just for a moment, if you haven't read the story before, that perhaps even God has now forgotten about Joseph. Which, of course, he is not. As one commentator writer put it, Hebrew writers enjoy telling stories in three episodes or scenes. The first two are typically quite alike, and then the third surprises by its differences. So we find this pattern all throughout the Pentateuch, actually. So in Genesis 14, you have three battles with Chedorlaomer, king of Elam, that are related. So the first battle, Chedorlaomer defeats everybody. And then we have the second battle. Chedorlaomer defeats everybody. And then you have Abraham fighting against Chedorlaomer. And the expectation has been built that this guy is unstoppable. He defeats everybody. And Abraham and his band of 318 defeat him. So you see how there's a pattern that's set? It's like A and then B, and then it catches you from the side and surprises you by the difference between the third episode. We find the same pattern in Leviticus 8 through 10. So you have a story in Leviticus 8 about how Moses and Aaron are doing exactly what God commanded, and the Lord blesses. Leviticus 9, Moses and Aaron are doing what the Lord commands, and the Lord is blessing. And then when you get to the beginning of Leviticus 10, Nadab and Abihu are doing what the Lord did not command, and even before you read the rest of the story, you know this is not going to end well, because it's this surprise factor. It's surprising by its difference. And then you have the same thing in Numbers 22 through 24. Balak attempts to get Balaam to prophesy. He attempts once. He doesn't do it. He attempts twice. He doesn't do it. The third time, he gives this astonishing pronouncement of blessing. And it catches you by surprise because your expectations have been set. This has happened. This has happened. And all of a sudden, something radically different happens. So this is just part of the way that Hebrew narrative works. So you can see this pattern all throughout the scriptures. And indeed, we see it here. There's this threefold patterning where the third one gives the new and exciting information where things turn out different than you expect. And so let's, any questions or comments about any of that before we dig into the chapter itself? Let's see. All right. Chapter 41, verses 1 through 8. And it came to pass at the end of 2 full years that Pharaoh dreamed, and behold, he stood by the river. And behold, there came out of the river 7 well-favored kine and fat-fleshed. And they fed in a meadow. And behold, 7 other kine came up after them out of the river, ill-favored and lean-fleshed, and stood by the other kine upon the brink of the river. And a kine is simply a cow. And the ill-favored and lean-fleshed kine, or cows, did eat up the 7 well-favored and fat kine, or cows. So Pharaoh awoke. And he slept and dreamed the second time. And behold, 7 ears of corn came up upon one stalk, rank and good. And behold, 7 thin ears, and blasted with the east wind, sprung up after them. And the 7 thin ears devoured the 7 rank in 4 years. And Pharaoh awoke, and behold, it was a dream. And it came to pass in the morning that his spirit was troubled. And he sent and called for all the magicians of Egypt and all the wise men thereof. And Pharaoh told them his dream. But there was none that could interpret them unto Pharaoh. Now there's one thing that's very important to notice. It really becomes the key to the rest of this chapter. As this is the narrator's authoritative retelling of what Pharaoh actually dreamed. And we're going to find there's a lot of confusion about what Pharaoh's dream looked like. And so, as related by the narrator, and this is something that the reader is given, but that we begin to realize that Pharaoh himself has missed, the magicians have missed, and all the Egyptians have missed the point. So we're in this position, and this is how the story is working, we're in this position of insider knowledge of what the dream really was. So that we're given that so that we can see how the so-called wise men of Egypt are missing it. And how initially we begin to think, and the narrator just gives us this idea that maybe Pharaoh is wiser than his magicians, but then he reveals that actually Pharaoh has missed it too. And Joseph, here's the key. Joseph doesn't interpret what Pharaoh tells Joseph. Joseph interprets the dream as the narrator tells it, not as Pharaoh relates it, which means Joseph has supernatural insight into what Pharaoh really dreams. And so later on, you know, when you have the Daniel and Nebuchadnezzar, Nebuchadnezzar can't remember his dream. And the Spirit of God tells Daniel what Nebuchadnezzar's dream was, and Daniel's able to interpret it. And so you might think, well, you know, Daniel has one up on Joseph, but Joseph sees through Pharaoh's mistelling of his dream. So how many of you ever heard of a red herring? How many of you like detective stories? So a red herring is when you take this really smelly fish and you create a false trail. So Pharaoh, we're going to see, creates a false trail about what his dream means, and Joseph has the wisdom to see, well, you smell through a red herring, you don't see through it, but he is able to sniff out what's really going on. So in order to be able to see what goes off in the retellings of the dream, we need to pay careful attention to the way the dream's initially told. And so, as related by the narrator, there are two dreams with two halves each. By careful paralleling of both word choice and grammatical structure, both of which come across with greater clarity in Hebrew, and later on when we get to Pharaoh's retelling, I'll talk a little bit about that, but we won't be able to dig into every grammatical detail. The narrator underscores the parallels between the two dreams as a whole, and also between the two halves of each dream. So there's a careful attempt to say, we have this half of the dream and this half of the dream. And each of these two dreams are both split in half. And there's a careful parallelism that parallels the dream about the cows with the dream about the wheat. And parallels the good cows and the bad cows and the good wheat and the bad wheat. So there's this parallelism, and that's really the point of the dream. And we're going to see that that becomes obscured. Crucially, equal emphasis is given to both the good and the bad halves of each of these two dreams. And so, as we shall see there, I've mentioned this before, but there are a number of fascinating differences between Pharaoh's dreams as reported by the narrator, the misunderstanding of the dream implied by the magicians in 41:8, Pharaoh's own distorted retelling of his dream in 41:17-24, and Joseph's inspired interpretation of the original dream in 41:25-32. And the differences between these three accounts are crucial to the storyline of the chapter. Let's just make a few comments on some more particular things in 41:1-8. So in 41:1, it says, "And it came to pass at the end of 2 full years." And the Hebrew phrase translated as 2 full years is literally 2 years of days. Shenatayim yamim, 2 years of days. And that's how you would say 2 full years in Hebrew. Years of days is a pretty standard expression. But you just, given that that's the way it's expressed, you can feel the weight. Years of individual days, each of them one after the other. And though God's plan to deliver Joseph was well underway, Joseph remained in unjust captivity for 2 more full years of days without the slightest sign that God was doing anything at all to help him. He didn't hear like this advance warning, okay, Joseph, in 1.5 years, Pharaoh's going to have a dream. It was years of days where he was apparently abandoned and forgotten. What are some of the situations in which we might be tempted to lose hope when we do not see visible evidence of God's faithfulness to us? Anyone have some suggestions? What are some situations in which we might be tempted to lose hope? Jackie? Mm-hmm. Long-term unemployment. Long-term unemployment is one of the most discouraging and difficult things to work around, especially if you're looking for a job and are not able to find one. Yes, absolutely. Brother Dave? Mm-hmm. Anyone else? What are some situations we might be tempted to lose hope? Pardon? When you can't get to where you need to get? That could show up in a lot of different situations in life where you're at one place in life and you need to get to a different place in life and it seems you have no hope of getting there. And really, that would be sort of a meta way to describe all the situations that were just mentioned. Brother TJ? Yes, death or long-term illness or unexplained trial. Michelle? Yep, that would be certainly a situation where that could apply. And yet, what we need to remember is that God had not forgotten about Joseph at all. And even though Joseph may have felt forgotten, he actually had not been. And all the while that Joseph was perhaps being tempted to feel neglected and abandoned in prison, God was at work to put the things in place that needed to be in place to bring him to the place of power and authority to save much people alive that God had been preparing all along. The word that's translated, so 41:1, by the river, is an Egyptian loan word that originally specifically referred to the Nile as it does here. And so it's not just the generic word for river, it's the specific word that refers to the Nile. Almost always in Scripture, it refers to the Nile. In later Hebrew, it becomes a little, it can refer to a few other rivers as well, but it really originally comes from an Egyptian word that refers to the Nile. And there's a number of words, as you'd expect in the story of Joseph, that have an Egyptian origin. They're very specific words that doesn't always come across in translation. And we talked about how kine just refers to cows, but there's something that's really interesting here, and that is the word that's translated as kine or cows sounds a lot like the word that's transliterated as Pharaoh. So an intentional wordplay is likely. Here's how close they are. So in Hebrew, just for reference, the p and the f sounds depends on what letters come before them. So those are interchangeable. But depending on which one you pick, you've got pero. Paro is the word that's Pharaoh. So it's paro or faro. And then you have parot is cows. So it's only the last t sound at the end that differentiates between cows and Pharaoh. And this is significant because when Pharaoh retells his dream, he's obsessed about these cows. He has almost nothing to say about the grains of wheat, but he's really concerned about these cows. And he goes into a great deal of detail that completely distorts the dream because he's probably thinking, well, this sounds like my name, so this must be the part of the dream that has to do something to do with me. Because there's this sound play that's going on. And so that's just, you know, it's one of those things that's difficult to prove, but it sounds so much alike. There's a little difference in the spelling, but the last consonant is, so I won't go into the technical details, but they sound a lot alike. And so some sort of wordplay is probably going on. When you get to 41:2, the word that's translated as meadow in the King James is once again a rare and very specific term of Egyptian origin describing the vegetation that occurs along the Nile. And though we will not deal with each of them individually, there are a number of unusual words in this chapter whose origin and specific meaning have been greatly clarified by the 19th century discovery and decoding of ancient Egyptian text. So in the 17th century, Egyptian literature was a sealed book. It had not only not been decoded, but it had not been discovered. But beginning in the late 16th century, and particularly in the time of Napoleon, there was much Egyptian, Napoleon and later on into the 19th century, there was a lot of stuff that was dug up in Egypt. And the Rosetta Stone enabled scholars in the late 18th century, the Rosetta Stone, maybe early 19th century, but that time period, the Rosetta Stone, how many of you have ever heard of the Rosetta Stone? So it was this tablet that had Egyptian hieroglyphics on it, but also other languages that were known, and because it was the same message in different languages, they were able to use it to decode Egyptian hieroglyphics for the first time. And so there are all these Egyptian words and Egyptian documents that weren't known before that have shed a lot of light on the specific nuances of different terms, particularly in the story of Joseph. When you go down to 41:5, 7 ears of corn. And when you see corn in the King James, it never refers to what we refer to as corn in America. It's not corn on the cob because that wasn't known in biblical times, nor was it probably known. It was just coming on the radar of Europeans in the early 17th century. So in English usage of the time, it simply refers to grain. Maize, the plant that Americans refer to as corn, was unknown to the biblical writers. And in UK English, corn continues to be a standard word for whatever the primary cereal crop of a given region is. In the UK, it's normally wheat. So this is some form of grain, probably some form of wheat. Of course, the forms of wheat we're familiar with today are the result of biological engineering over the millennia and may or may not be have any particular resemblance to the forms of wheat that were known in Egypt thousands of years ago. But don't think of corn on the cob. Think of ears of wheat, something along those lines. In 41:5, and I'm just going to read 41:5 again so you get the overall picture here. So 41:5, and he slept and dreamed the second time, And behold, 7 ears of corn or wheat came up upon one stalk, rank and good. So the word that's here translated as rank, describing the ears, is the same word that's translated as fat-fleshed in verse 2. And that's significant because this is the only passage in the entire Old Testament in which this adjective is applied to anything other than a person or animal. So the idea of fat-fleshed is the normal idea, and it's never anywhere else is it used to refer to an inanimate object. So remember I mentioned earlier how there was intentional paralleling between the story, between the dream about the ears of grain and the cows? This is one of the ways in which that done is an adjective that never, ever elsewhere refers to a plant, is used to refer to a plant in order for it to be the same adjective that's used to refer to the cows in order to make the point that it's talking about the same thing. And the unusual use of this term serves to underscore the parallelism between the two portions of Pharaoh's dream, as mentioned above. We get down to 41:8, the end of this paragraph. And it came to pass in the morning that his spirit was troubled, and he sent and called for all the magicians of Egypt and all the wise men thereof. And Pharaoh told them his dream, but there was none that could interpret them unto Pharaoh. None that could interpret them, as one commentator pointed out, does not mean they did not make suggestions as to the meaning of the dreams, but that none of their ideas satisfied Pharaoh. It wasn't like they were left speechless by these dreams necessarily, but simply that Pharaoh was like, whatever the dream means, it doesn't mean that. And actually, it doesn't mean that either. I don't know what it means, but I know you're just talking nonsense, so stop it already. And here's one of the subtle things, right? So here's how badly the magicians have misunderstood Pharaoh's dream. Note that although Pharaoh tells them his dream, so this is very important, Pharaoh told them his dream, but there was none that could interpret. What's the next word? If you're following along, 41:8. There was none that could interpret them unto Pharaoh. So although Pharaoh told them his dream, the magicians continued to try to interpret them. Rather than realizing that the two dreams had a unified message, they foolishly were attempting to interpret each of them individually. So this idea of the unity, how the two dreams are united, and how in which ways they're different, is the central point of interpreting it that Joseph gets that nobody else does. And so initially, Pharaoh tells them his dream. So Pharaoh gets the connection between the two dreams, we think, but we're about to see that he's mixed it up in another way. So the magicians completely miss it. But initially, we think maybe Pharaoh understands something about his dream. Well, does he really? We'll find out. But before we move on to the next section, any questions or comments about 1 through 8? Yes? Yeah, we'll talk about that. Anyone else? All right, let's move right along. 41:9. Then spake the chief butler unto Pharaoh, saying, I do remember my faults this day. Pharaoh was wroth with his servants, and put me in ward in the captain of the guard's house, both me and the chief baker. And we dreamed a dream in one night, I and he. We dreamed each man according to the interpretation of his dream. And there was with us a young man, an Hebrew, servant to the captain of the guard. And we told him, and he interpreted to us our dreams, to each man according to his dream he did interpret. And it came to pass, as he interpreted to us, so it was. Me he restored unto mine office, and him he hanged. The word translated here as remember, when he says, I do remember my faults this day, is the same Hebrew word, as one commentator pointed out, used by Joseph in his plea in 40:14. And the reason I'm making this point is because in 40:14 it's translated differently, as make mention. But in Hebrew, it's the same word. And by the narrator in reporting the ingratitude of the cupbearer in 40:23. So it's not Joseph forgot, but Joseph did, the cupbearer did not remember. So we have in each of these three passages where it talks about what the cupbearer did, it's using the same word to tie them together. And the similarity of language conveys a direct relationship between the events. Hence he speaks of his offenses in the plural, that is against Pharaoh and against Joseph. And so the butler, very late in the game, remembers Joseph's goodness to him in prison after forgetting about it for 2 years. Moving on to verse 14. Then Pharaoh sent and called Joseph, and they brought him hastily out of the dungeon. And he shaved himself and changed his raiment and came in unto Pharaoh. And Pharaoh said unto Joseph, I have dreamed a dream, and there is none that can interpret it. And I have heard say of thee that thou canst understand a dream to interpret it. And Joseph answered Pharaoh, saying, It is not in me. God shall give Pharaoh an answer of peace. And Pharaoh said unto Joseph, Listen to how Pharaoh tells his dream. In my dream, behold, I stood upon the bank of the river. And behold, there came up out of the river seven kine, fat-fleshed and well-favored, and they fed in a meadow. And behold, seven other kine came up after them, poor and very ill-favored and lean-fleshed, such as I never saw in all the land of Egypt for badness. And the lean and the ill-favored kine did eat up the first seven fat kine, and when they had eaten them up, it could not be known that they had eaten them, but they were still ill-favored as at the beginning. Do you see how massively Pharaoh has expanded his description of the sick cows? He's obsessed over these scrawny cows. He's like, I never saw cows like this. And then when they ate up the other cows, they didn't even get any fatter. So he is really worried about these scrawny cows. He maybe wonders perhaps if the dream is prophesying indigestion for him, that he will not be able to eat and he will become scrawny or something like that. We don't know what he was thinking. But you see, there's this careful balancing. Seven good cows, seven bad cows. And Pharaoh's like, seven good cows, seven bad cows! Seven bad cows! They're really bad cows! This has got to be what the dream's about. These bad cows. You see the... And then listen to how quickly he goes over the stalks of grain. So I awoke, and I saw my dream, and behold, seven ears came up in one stalk, full and good, and behold, seven ears withered, thin and blasted with the east wind, sprang up after them, and the thin ears devoured the seven good ears. He just goes that perfunctorily. You see, he's unbalanced the dream. So it's not a wonder that the magicians were struggling to interpret this dream. I told this unto the magicians, but there was none that could declare it to me. So we're going to go back to Pharaoh's dream here in a minute. But in 14, why didn't Joseph's brothers recognize him when they come in the next chapter? This chapter tells us why they didn't recognize him. He shaves. So here's something we know. What did you say? Yep, there's that too. The first thing that happens is he shaves. So we actually have, like, you know, art in the pyramids and other Egyptian monuments from the relevant time period. And one of the things you'll notice if you look at that art is the Egyptians are clean shaven, and all of the Semitic peoples, including the Jews would be Semitic peoples, they all have big beards. So one of the ways you can tell the Egyptians and the Hebrews and others apart is by beards or no beards versus beards. So anyone you look at and you see and they're clean shaven, you're immediately going to assume that they're an Egyptian, not someone from Canaan, not one of the Semitic peoples. The process of transformation will be completed in 41-42 with Pharaoh's bestowal, as you mentioned, of a new linen garment and a new gold collar. So Joseph in this chapter is being transformed to look like an Egyptian. You can see this process of transformation as you go throughout the chapter. And so it's no surprise in 42 he recognizes them because they look the same as they always did, just a little bit older. But he looks radically different. That's why they don't recognize him. So paying attention to the details in this chapter makes sense of the details of the next chapter. 41:16, and Joseph answered Pharaoh, saying, It is not in me. God shall give Joseph an answer of peace. Even though impressing Pharaoh was Joseph's only hope for deliverance from unjust captivity, he was careful to humbly give God the credit for his ability to interpret Pharaoh's dreams. If Joseph's behavior as a teenager is best understood as prideful and arrogant, and again, there could be room for disagreement about that, this represents a striking transformation from self-promotion to self-deprecation, the same sort of reversal that took place in the life of his brother Judah. In either case, the words of the Apostle Peter ring true. Humble yourselves, therefore, under the mighty hand of God, that he might exalt you in due time. And in our own lives, how might we be tempted to accept some of the glory that belongs to God alone? What would be some of the ways we could be tempted to accept some of the glory that belongs to God? I think one of the ways it can happen particularly is when God gives us something that benefits someone else and it really changes their life and we want to take credit sometimes for the transformation in their life or even hold it over their heads like, where would you be without me in your life? And it may be that God was the one who put us there to say that. So it wasn't that we had this incredible wisdom, but God put us in the right place at the right time to maybe say something perfectly ordinary that was nevertheless exactly what that person needed to hear. And it wasn't our wisdom that changed their life, but it was God putting us in the right place at the right time that was transformative. Rick?
Sometimes God gives us a word that allows us to accomplish the task that other people around us can begin to obstacles, and we overcome the obstacles by God's grace. So we want to take
Yeah. There's a lot of other ways. This is a really easy thing to do, but it's something that Joseph avoids. And as we dig into the dream, Pharaoh's retelling of the dream distorts the narrator's careful summary in two significant ways. So first, although Pharaoh, unlike his magicians, understands that the two dreams belong together. So Pharaoh, remember, he tells them the dream. He understands the dreams belong together. He misunderstands the unity of the two dreams. So while the narrator makes clear that Pharaoh dreamed twice, so you have dreamed the second time in verse 5, like you mentioned, he dreamed, he woke up, he fell asleep again and dreamed again. Pharaoh's retelling makes the ears of grain a second consecutive portion of the same dream. So Pharaoh runs the dreams together. There's a significant difference between two separate dreams that have a single unified meaning, which therefore must be interpreted in parallel. So they're going over the ground, and they're going over the same ground again from a different angle. So that's a unity of parallelism, which is how the narrator puts it together. And two consecutive sections of a single dream, which should be interpreted sequentially. So Pharaoh gets that the dreams belong together, but he's misunderstood how the dreams belong together. So you can see he thinks it's one story, and he misinterprets how that should go together. And so the difference between the two may sound subtle. The change profoundly obscures the nature of the message that God gave to Pharaoh in the dream, because the parallelism between the two parts, the two sides of the dream, or the two dreams, is the point, as Joseph is going to make clear, and that's the point that Pharaoh has obscured, and that's why his dream interpreters cannot make any sense of his dream. Second, in his terror at the specter of carnivorous cows, remember they sounded like him, so he probably thought that was the part of the dream that had to do with him. Pharaoh completely overturns the careful balancing between the two halves of each dream. So while the narrator's account uses four Hebrew words to describe each set of seven cows, so you have a literal translation would be beautiful of appearance and fat of flesh, and evil of appearance and thin of flesh. So you can see how there's very careful parallelism between the way the good cows and the bad cows are described. Just the adjectives are swapped out. So you've got beautiful of appearance and fat of flesh, evil of appearance and thinner flesh. Pharaoh's retelling, while using four words to describe the healthy cows, uses no less than 13 words to describe the unhealthy cows. And this completely refocuses the dream and obscures its true meaning. As we'll see, Joseph, aided by divine assistance, was able to see through Pharaoh's distorted retelling in order to interpret the dream that God actually sent. Any questions about that section or comments before we move on?
Do you think there's a reason why there are two dreams? Maybe just emphasize that this is just...
Joseph tells us why. Yeah, later on when we get there, he makes a point of that. Brother Tanaka? Yeah, but I think it's... Yeah, except that the writer, except that Genesis is so chock full of these sorts of wordplays that it's a point the narrator is making, regardless of whether, you know, so we're dealing not primarily with trying to get inside of Pharaoh's head, but getting the story that's being told in the text. And in the text, it is a wordplay. And these sorts of wordplays are so common, and they're so, they're such a part of the way that Hebrew writing is done that it, I don't think it is reading it. I don't think it is reading into it. Right. Yeah. So I don't know. You know, I have no idea what was, you know, all we have is what the text says. And this is something that I think the original audience would have been intended to pick up on and would have picked up on. And this is something that Hebrew writing is so full of and so intentional about that I think it's helpful to highlight, even if it's something that's part of the way the story is being told. But it's there's this subtle, throughout the story of Joseph, you know, remember, they just got delivered from Egyptian captivity, so it's kind of poking fun at Pharaoh and his magicians. So there's an element of humor in it, and part of that element of humor is in the way these wordplays take place. And so, you know, you could make the case, well, we don't even know what words that, you know, what Egyptian words Pharaoh would have thought, you know, so, you know, one level, we don't know that. And of course, I agree with that. But at another level, we do know what words the story is told in, and we do know that both the original writer and the original audience had a great delight in this sort of wordplay, because Genesis is just completely packed full of it, as indeed is most of the rest of the Old Testament. And so I think it's appropriate to point out things that the original audience would have recognized, because we're not necessarily trying to get behind the text to, you know, we're trying to get the message that's being given in the text. So that could be a broader discussion for sure. But this is not the only place that this occurs. There are lots of wordplays throughout Scripture where it's like, well, you know, this is a wordplay that works in Greek, but maybe Jesus was speaking in Aramaic, but ultimately we're given a gospel in Greek. And the original message is inspired to an audience that understood Greek, or in the case of the Old Testament, that understood Hebrew. So we've got to work with what we have as opposed to what we don't have. I certainly wouldn't want to stake a doctrine on that wordplay, but it's funny, and the text is supposed to be funny, and that's part of what makes it funny. I don't know. I mean, to be honest, we don't even know if Joseph spoke Hebrew as we would recognize Hebrew. You know, like, the changes of the linguistic changes that take place, you know, like, did Joseph speak the Hebrew we have in Genesis? We don't even know that. What we do know is that Genesis is written in Hebrew, and we can interpret that and, you know, trust that it's a trustworthy rendition of, you know, trustworthy rendition of the events that took place, and any humorous elements that are added in are sufficiently in keeping with what actually took place. So, you know, to try to figure out what word, you know, we can be sometimes, you know, overly historical of like trying to figure out, you know, what would Proto-Hebrew have sounded like and how would that have related to Proto-Egyptian, and it really gets into a lot of things we just can't know, and sometimes it's more, you know, what the point the text is making. And I do think it's a subtle thing, right? It's not like I would never bring that up in a theological discussion, but I think part of reading the story is getting the subtle humor that's in it and listening for the jokes the writer is making, because the Bible is full of jokes, actually, of just exactly this sort, and this is something they delight in, so that's all I'm trying to point out. And Pharaoh does, like, really zero in on these sickly cows, so maybe he did, you know, think that. Anyone else? There was someone else. Gil? Yeah, I think that's the case as well. It's not nearly as dramatic as with the cows, but he's completely unbalanced the dream across the board. So he's really much more worried about the bad than he is impressed by the good. Oh, he just commented that there's a more detailed description of the bad ears of grain as well than of the good ears of grain as well. So that same pattern we see with the cows also plays over in the grain. It just isn't nearly as extreme. Anyone else before we move on? Good questions and comments. So now let's talk about Joseph's interpretation of Pharaoh's dream. And Joseph said unto Pharaoh, "The dream of Pharaoh is one. God hath showed Pharaoh what he is about to do. The seven good kinds are 7 years, and the seven good years are 7 years. The dream is one. And the seven thin and ill-favored kind that came up after them are 7 years, and the seven empty ears blasted with the east wind shall be 7 years of famine. This is the thing which I have spoken unto Pharaoh. What God is about to do, he showeth unto Pharaoh." And you see how Joseph has perfectly restored the parallelism between cows and ears, good and bad cows, good and bad ears. That's the point of the dream. Joseph got it. Pharaoh and his magicians missed it. What God is about to do, he showeth unto Pharaoh. Verse 29. "Behold, there come 7 years of great plenty throughout all the land of Egypt. And there shall arise after them 7 years of famine. And all the plenty shall be forgotten in the land of Egypt, and the famine shall consume the land. And the plenty shall not be known in the land by reason of that famine following, for it shall be very grievous. And for that the dream was doubled unto Pharaoh twice, it is because the thing is established by God, and God will shortly bring it to pass." The reason it was doubled is because it's happening right away, and it's happening for sure. So unlike the magicians who thought of them as separate dreams, and Pharaoh, who messed with the proportions and turned a unity of parallelism into a unity of sequence, Joseph understood that the key to the dream was that it was a single dream that had been doubled and must therefore be understood in parallel, and that the cows and the ears of grain were two different ways of describing the same reality. And Joseph's skill in decoding Pharaoh's distortions was every bit as great as Daniel's skill in interpreting Nebuchadnezzar's forgotten dream. And verse 25, "God has showed Pharaoh what he is about to do." Verse 32, "And for that the dream was doubled unto Pharaoh twice, it is because the theme is established by God, and God will shortly bring it to pass." As one commentator put it, Joseph does not barely say that God will declare beforehand what may happen from some other quarter, but what he himself is about to do. Above all things, it is right to be fully persuaded that whenever the earth is barren, whether frost or drought or hail or any other thing may be the cause of it, the whole result is directed by the counsel of God. This isn't simply an extrapolation from this text, but is the clear teaching of Scripture elsewhere. We find in Isaiah 45:7, "I form the light and create darkness. I make peace and create evil. I, the Lord, do all these things." And this does not mean that the Lord makes moral evil the way we use the word evil, like we'd say Hitler is evil or something like that. That's not the Hebrew term that underlies this is much greater, is much broader than that. As another translation puts this verse, "I am the one who forms light and creates darkness, the one who brings about peace and creates calamity," which is much closer to the sense of the word here. "I am the Lord who accomplishes all these things." In Ephesians 1:11, we find this, "In him we have obtained an inheritance, having been predestined according to the purpose of him who works all things, according to the counsel of his will." Examples could, of course, be multiplied. And yet we only understand God's sovereignty rightly when we realize that far from removing responsibility from man, it is in fact the only foundation for meaningful human action, as we'll discuss in more detail in the very next section. And before we discuss that, we need to see the second half of this that we find in the next section. So Joseph tells Pharaoh, God is going to do this. God's the one who's going to accomplish this. So what does Joseph say? "Since God's going to accomplish this, let's all sit down and cry about it." That's not what he says. 41:33. "Now therefore, as a result of God promising he's going to do exactly this, and he's the one who's going to accomplish it, let Pharaoh look out a man discreet and wise and set him over the land of Egypt. Let Pharaoh do this, and let him appoint officers over the land, and take up the fifth part of the land of Egypt in the seven plenteous years. And let them gather all the food of those good years that come, and lay up corn under the hand of Pharaoh, and let them keep food in the cities. And that food shall be for store to the land against the 7 years of famine, which shall be in the land of Egypt, that the land perish not through the famine. And the thing was good in the eyes of Pharaoh and in the eyes of all his servants. And though Joseph fully recognized God's sovereign control of all things, revealing to Pharaoh what God is about to do, he followed up this recognition with a detailed plan for vigorous human action. Joseph used his very confidence in God's sovereign plan as the foundation for suggesting vigorous human action, which he then spent the better part of a decade implementing. God's sovereignty and man's responsibility are not in conflict because divine action and creaturely action are not of the same order. God's freedom is not in conflict with our freedom. In fact, God's freedom is the only possible foundation for human freedom. The Creator is not like his creatures, just a little bit bigger. He's the Creator, not the creatures, not his creatures. Those who deny divine sovereignty make God like a man, and those who think man's freedom in some way limits God's sovereignty turn man into God. So how might we be tempted to either downplay God's absolute sovereignty or ignore our own responsibility? So here are some examples of how we could do that. We could believe that we can force God to give us what we want if we only follow the right steps. So we could have the mindset that if I do these steps, I can force God to send a revival. I can force God to send me the perfect spouse. I can force God. If I fast and pray enough, he will give me a child. If I fast and pray enough, and if I do all of these things, I can force my children to turn out right. We could multiply examples of all of the ways in which we might think, well, God's sovereign, but if I do things right, if I play my cards right, I can get God to do what I want. So that would be downplaying God's sovereignty. On the other hand, we could fail to act at all because we falsely believe God's power to be a substitute for our obedience to what he's already given us to do. So on the other hand, so while the one person could think, you know, if I just play my cards right, I can get the perfect spouse. And the other person could think, well, God's sovereign, he's the one who's in control. So I'm never, you know, so a young man could think, you know what, I'm not going to talk to a girl until God hits me on the head and says that she's the one. So I'm just going to sit on the couch and play video games and hope for God to bring the perfect woman along. That's a bad understanding of God's sovereignty. God's sovereignty is not a substitute for human action. It's the foundation for human action. And we can't, at the same time, human action can't control God's sovereignty. These are two sides of the same coin. And though we cannot always understand how they work together, we can most assuredly be sure. It didn't really work. But we can be sure that they do work together because Scripture makes it clear that they do. What would be some other ways we might be tempted to downplay God's sovereignty or ignore our own responsibility? Absolutely. Yeah. On the one hand, we might think that if we can manipulate people into the kingdom of God, you know, on the other hand, we could say, you know what, if God wants to save them, he will without your help or mine, so sit down and don't worry about it. And both of those are very wrong responses. Anyone else? Yeah, tempting the Lord. Yes. Mm-hmm. Trying to put God in a box and saying, you know, yeah, exactly. And that's what Jesus refused to do when he said, I'm not going to jump off the temple and prove God's love for me. That's not appropriate. I'm not going to do it. Anyone else? All right. Well, let's see. We don't really have time to get to the next few verses, so we will pick up where we left off next week. So let's go before the Lord in prayer. Any final, I think we have time for one more question or comment. Brother TJ.
I think it's interesting how Pharaoh never asked him to tell him to
do it. Yep. Mm-hmm. Yep. Yep. Yes. And Philemon, I missed you before, so.
I was just going to ask, you said multiple times that God's sovereignty is the foundation for
Yeah, well, it's because God is God that God has the liberty to create creatures who can, so because we are created in the image of God, so we are reflections of God. So only to the extent that God is free do we have the ability to, in a creaturely way, mimic God's freedom. So if God were not free, we would not be able to have any freedom to reflect. So everything that is good about human beings comes from their ability to reflect what is ultimately and fundamentally good about God. So I think that's what I meant by that. Obviously, some of the terms of the discussion, we could get into a really big theological discussion, but I think the main point is God can't give us what God doesn't have. And if God doesn't have something foundational, so one of the terms that has been really helpful for me is that God's freedom and man's freedom are not in conflict, because we often think, you know, mankind has freedom, and if God is free and sovereign, then God is stealing pieces of our freedom pie. So the extent that God is sovereign, then we are not free. But actually, the biblical teaching is that God has his own pie that's not dependent on us. He doesn't need to borrow our freedom, because he has all the freedom that he needs of his own. And in fact, because he is absolutely free, he can give us the sort of freedom that's appropriate to us as a creature. Just like because God is all-powerful, he can give us a certain amount of creaturely power that we are free to exercise. So does that answer your question? And in fact, I'm going to be talking about this, Lord willing, this Sunday. As we move forward in 1 John, it's this whole thing comes up in the next passage, so we'll talk about it in more detail then. One more, and then we got to be done.
Mm-hmm.
Yep. And there's actually a pattern in Genesis that Pharaoh isn't the only foreign king in Genesis to be given a dream from God. So you have Abimelech is also given a dream from God, and Laban is given a dream from God. So you have a pattern of dreams from God being given to unbelieving rulers or heads of household. So it's this overall pattern. So we need to be done, because you have to go pick up your kids. But we can pick this up next week, and if any of you have any suggestions or feedback about how tonight went and the future, please let me know. You are dismissed.